side, and I just pray that we'll be standing by him this morning. I want to share with you a scripture before we get to the sermon in Matthew chapter 7, verse 17. Matthew 7th chapter, 17th verse. Every good tree bears good fruit, but a bad tree bears bad fruit. A good tree cannot bear bad fruit, and a bad tree cannot bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Thus, by their fruit, you will recognize them. May God bless you as Todd shares the word with us this morning.
I need a bigger pulpit today. Remember, you can laugh when I'm up here. It's okay. Laughter is good. I got to tell you, there's a couple things I really dislike about preaching. So much, I'd almost say I hate certain things when I have to preach, but I won't go that far. There's some things I really dislike. Number one, the cell phone's going off when you're trying to preach a sermon. Not only does it distract you in the flow of your sermon, but it distracts everybody else. And I guarantee Satan knows whose cell phones are on, and he purposely makes those things go off in the middle of the sermon to distract us. And I appreciate Walter so much having slides up there to say to you, silent your cell phones. Or as I like to say, put your phasers on stun if you're a Trekkie. Okay? So please, yeah, there we go. Please do that for me. The second thing is I really, really dislike these two clocks looking at me when I'm up here up front. And I can guarantee you every elder, every preacher that gets up here does, because we work very hard at preparing a sermon and God's speaking to us, and we want to make sure we can share everything he's speaking with us to you. So I would be okay, Wes, if whenever you see me up here preaching, you take those clocks down because I don't want to see them. I try to be courteous and get us out of here at noon, but it's not going to happen, I guarantee it. And the third thing I really dislike is trying to preach a sermon after all the wonderful music we have in this church. Those are sermons in themselves. Why even bother? We just come here, listen to the music, and go home, and I'd be blessed for the day. But I'm going to do my best, because as I said in my prayer, God's been thumping me for some reason with this sermon and the sermon title for a long time now. So before we start, let's bow our heads for just a very short prayer. Good morning, Father. It's me again. Father, I pray that today our one goal is that each one in this congregation, each one watching online, can find their tree. Amen. Let me start this by telling you a little bit about myself and how I grew up. I was born in the big town in northern Idaho called Bonner's Ferry. Population 2,500. I'm not joking when I say it was a big town. That was the city. Because the town I actually lived in was about 8 miles outside of Bonner's Ferry called Moyer Springs. And this is way up in the panhandle of Idaho if you're not familiar where it's at. And Moyer Springs had a population of 250. Moyer Springs has one general store that was owned for years by my cousin. It has a post office. It had a bar. It no longer has a bar. The bar burned down. They didn't rebuild it. Praise God. But the bars where everybody hung out. The other big industry in Moyer Springs that actually hired people from all around was their lumber mill. That lumber mill at one time was started and owned by my grandfather. And he employed a lot of people in the community. And he employed a lot of my uncles. They all worked at the mill. And when my grandfather finally sold the mill to a bigger company, a lot of my dad and my uncles stayed working there at the lumber mill. So the trees they milled in this part of Idaho were giant western red cedars. And I remember after my grandfather passed, looking through some of his old photos and some of his old shoe boxes, and he had photos of him sitting on top of these giant red cedar logs. Huge. Bigger than a house. Being pulled by a mule train. And my grandfather sitting on top of the log, driving those mules to the mill. Fascinating, fascinating pictures. Well, my grandfather loved his trees. He understood that those red cedars provided him with life. He loved the forest, and even though he was a logger and all my family were loggers, they respected the forest. My grandfather was attuned with the forest and the wildlife, and he passed that on to me. And I grew up seeing wildlife every day. Bears would come up into our garden, deer, elk, moose. Occasionally a caribou, believe it or not, would come down to our part of the state. And yes, I heard fascinating stories of a creature that lived in the woods called Sasquatch, Bigfoot, the abominable snowman. And in honor of my grandfather and my father telling those stories, I wore my Sasquatch socks today. So if you ask me if I believe, some of you know what my answer will be. Absolutely. It's more than a mythical creature to me. It's part of what I grew up with. It's part of my heritage, part of my family's legacy. Well, my grandfather, when I was about 5 years old, he was 72, had no inkling of a health problem, of health issues of any kind. He got up one morning during the middle of the week and put on his best Sunday suit, a nice black suit. He put on his tie, flopped his fedora on his head, grabbed his cane, and walked out into the forest behind his home. Now, his home was actually built on the property of the lumber mill. So even when he sold out the lumber mill, they let him keep his property. And on one half of his property was a lumber mill all behind him with all those beautiful red cedars being milled behind it. And the smell there was always wonderful. I love the smell of cedar to this day. And we'd walk by on our route to go get the school bus right by the lumber mill, and we'd smell that red cedar being cut. The back half of my grandfather's house went back into the forest. And in that forest, he had some big, large western red cedars that never got touched by the mill. Those are my grandpa's trees. My grandpa walked out into the forest, found his big red cedar. I don't know how emotional about this. This happened 50 years ago. He sat down at that tree, and he passed away. He knew it was coming. He knew it was his last day on earth, and he wanted to share it with the trees he loved. That legacy my grandfather had passed on to me. If you know me, I love the outdoors. I love the forest. I love the animals in the forest. I love spotting animals in the forest. I love the trees. And fortunately for me, I married somebody who loves the outdoors as much as I do. Now, you may see my wife and think, wow, she's not the outdoorsy type. Let me tell you something. She puts on her muck and boots on her farm, and she gets out there and cuts the wood, pulls the weeds, cleans up after the chickens and the turkeys and the llama. And she's still beautiful when she does it. But after years of being in Pathfinders and going camping, we still like to camp, but now we do it in a RV, except when we want to get out into the woods, and then we backpack. We love to backpack, because you get to places nobody else can get. You don't have 20, 25 screaming kids, no offense, Cody, screaming kids with you. You have to feed and take care of and bring all their equipment. It's very minimal camping. So here, 3 or so years ago, we did a backpacking trip up into the Mount Hood Wilderness area to a place called Elk Meadows. Anybody ever backpacked Elk Meadows in this area? No. Well, let me tell you about the trip out to Elk Meadows. So when you backpack out to Elk Meadows, you drop in the Mount Hood Wilderness area, and you're in the area of Mount Hood. And you start in a parking lot, very unassuming. The trail's relatively flat when you start off. A lot of people hiking the trail when you start. Those people diminish as you get further in. You'll understand why. You're hiking through the forest. There's big, beautiful trees. There's deers frolicking through the sunlight. Deers, deer. Moose, mises, right, Abby? All kinds of wildlife, all kinds of birds. A few sporadic huckleberry plants. And if you know me, huckleberries, they attract me like a giant magnet. And the ground's relatively flat. It's some hills. And then you get to this bridge over this gully. When you get to this bridge, you actually have to stop. And if you're going any further from this point, you have to sign in and basically sign your life away. Because the state of Oregon is going to take no responsibility for you at this point. You're on your own. So you cross over this bridge and hike a little further, and the trail's still fine. And then you get to Myrtle Creek. Sounds like a pleasant place, doesn't it? Myrtle Creek? Out in the forest? A little creek trickling by? Oh, no, no, no. Myrtle Creek is made by the glacial melt and the snow melt from Mount Hood. And in the springtime, it is a raging river. It is so bad they can't put a bridge across Myrtle Creek at this point to cross. This place is full of huge boulders and dead trees that have been washed down. And every year during the summer, the first backpackers that get to this point have to find a way to cross. The creek's come down quite a bit by then, but it's still pretty raging and very cold water. You don't want to fall in. So they find a good couple of boulders where they can cross, and they find an old dead log and they put it across, and you cross Myrtle Creek, raging water flowing below you, ice cold raging water, by crossing on a tree. Now, we go on our backpacking trips. We take our pit bull Ripley with us. You've heard about Ripley. I've given a sermon about Ripley before. Ripley carries her own backpack and her own doggy sleeping bag. She packs her own food. And yes, they do make a backpacking doggy sleeping bag, believe it or not. And everybody is amazed by Ripley because here she is, this big old meaty, stocky pit bull. But she is as sure-footed as any dog I've ever seen. We were up there one day and the people had a Australian Shepherd, very fleet-footed dog, that went across the log without any backpack, lost its footing and fell in. They were able to rescue the dog, but when we got there, they were like, are you taking your pit bull across this log? Yeah, with a big old backpack on and everything, and Ripley just followed me right across the log, never hesitated, never worried about it. She was sure-footed. So you get across Myrtle Creek, and then the real fun begins. Once you get across Myrtle Creek, you immediately start up this plateau. The trail goes across the plateau, straight down on one side, straight up on the other, about 3 to 4 feet to walk. And it's straight up, almost. It's a hard, tough hike. And along the way, you find some of these big western red cedars growing along the edge of this cliff face, basically, plateau. And these big red cedars, when you see them, they're solid in the ground. The roots go down deep. The roots reach out and hold up the bank, keep the erosion from happening. They're wrapped around great big boulders, and those trees are solid. And I love that about the trees. You eventually get up onto the plateau, and it's still an uphill climb to get to the meadow, but it's not so bad. You have a few down areas, but it's still a pretty good climb. When you get to this point, some of the trees have been cleared out due to previous fires from years and years and years ago. And if you know anything about huckleberries, You know, when you find these burned out areas, you're going to find where the huckleberries grow because it's got the sunlight that comes through. And when you get to this point, the huckleberries are everywhere. And from here to Elk Meadows, if you don't wind up with a purple face and purple hands, you're hiking wrong. Because you've got to collect the berries as you go and eat them as you go and have plenty to bring home when you go. During the hike, you cannot see Mount Hood anywhere, even though you're right there by Mount Hood. This is actually a photo I took. These are not off the internet. These are photos I took with my cell phone. There's points you come through the trees and you get glimpses of Mount Hood there in the background. And it's beautiful. But the trees veil it from you most of the time and just give you a peek. Then you get up to your campsite and you set up camp. Now they have designated campsites around Elk Meadow. And Elk Meadow, you'll see, is a big open meadow full of wildflowers. When you get there, you set up your camp, you set up your little tent, and I don't think we've ever had anybody camp there while we've been there. We very rarely see anybody else even come by. And after you hike that hike, you can understand why. But what's beautiful about the campsite, and there's Ripley right there, all satisfied she made it, is you have all these wonderful trees for the shade, so it doesn't get too hot. You have trees to hang your backpack in, trees to hang your food up in so the bears don't get it, right? And you just notice there's logs that have been cut down probably by the Forest Service that are used as a table and a chair. So you have a little bit of comfort there as well. And behind you, there's that big block of trees there, and you cannot see the meadow, but you're only 10 feet from the meadow. Literally 10 feet from the meadow. But you walk out past the trees, and you get this glorious meadow of wildflowers and Mount Hood in the background, and every morning and every evening, this is where we would sit and eat our meals, looking at Mount Hood. Beautiful, beautiful area. And I love all the trees. Trees, they're an amazing creation, really. And trees are so important to our life here on earth. And hopefully by the end of today, you'll understand how important trees are to our Christianity. I'm going to read you a story, and I was going to try to memorize a story, but it's 3 pages long. It's something I found on the internet, and when I found it, I went, that fits perfectly with what I'm trying to say today. I didn't write it, and bear with me as I read it, because I hate reading while I'm up here. But this is the story of the Bible as told by the trees. Whoa. Somebody's in trouble. In the beginning, God said, let there be a world filled with light and dark, turning from day to night and back again. Let there be earth and sky and land, and right in the midst of it all, let there be trees. Trees are the seed-bearing and the fruit kind in particular. God then gave the trees to all the beasts. They were a gift. The trees were a gift at creation. And all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that had the breath of life in it, the trees were a gift from the Creator for the flourishing of life on His newly made earth. And we thought we were important that God formed us from the dirt with His own hands and breathed His breath into us. But He gave us the trees so we could flourish. And it was so. And it was good. Trees are a sign and symbol of the existence of life itself, which should be unsurprising since they are the longest living organisms on earth. Methuselah. Has anybody ever seen Methuselah? No? She's a bristlecone pine in California's White Mountains that they figure the age of this tree is 4,800 years. Imagine that. When Christ was born and crucified on this earth, this tree was still 2,800 years old already. That tree probably appeared right after the floodwaters receded. And she's still alive today. What stories could she tell? In the Bible, trees are often signposts and gathering places. They provide images of both the blessings and the judgment of God. You can tell how a Bible story is going based on what's happening to the trees. In the time of Noah, the fate of the whole earth itself was in jeopardy. And trees and the sap of trees were used to build the vessel, build the lifeboat, to carry man and beast on through the tragic flood. During the flood, the trees were wiped out. Every tree was wiped out on earth. But God was not quite done with the whole shebang, and Noah sent out a dove searching for some sign of life in the aftermath of the deluge. When it came back with a leaf from an olive tree in its beak, no one knew there was a chance. A chance for the story to move forward, however tentatively, towards some kind of better resolution. Then Abraham, the chosen as God's answer to Adam's failure, was brought to a new land to help the story get a new start. After surveying the length and breadth of this unfamiliar place, he decided to settle in the vicinity of the great trees of Mamre, a place he did not own. He was a sojourner at this point, someone living off the promise not yet turned reality. The Bible story is always a story of promises. Amen? It does get to some already's, but there are always more not yet's. Abraham was staking the future on that place of the great trees, believing against the evidence that great things would be done by his own as yet non-existent family. And it would all be for the sake of the life of this world. When Abraham's family turns into a nation of slaves, God sends a man with a wooden staff to rescue them. God's power flares from that staff, and the road to freedom is opened. Can you imagine that tree, Moses' staff, when he used it to part the Red Sea and open that gate to freedom? Can you imagine the power that staff, that tree, must have felt coursing through it? God himself coming through that staff, through Moses, that tree, that dead piece of wood, probably came alive with the touch of God. God leads them to camping spaces like Elim, home to 12 springs and 70 palm trees, islands of trees, proof of water nearby, or lifelines to a new land. Trees end up being the barometer of blessings of the covenant bond between Israel and God. When Israel celebrates how God rescued them, the festival begins with the people taking branches of luxuriant trees from palms, willows, and other leafy trees to build temporary shelters as they remember the Exodus and rejoice before the Lord for 7 days. Covenant faithfulness means that Israel's good life in a good land will be marked by thriving crops and trees, with a harvest of produce and fruit lasting all the way through the next growing season. And around the edges of the orchard, there is still enough fruit for the poor to be fed too. The trees. Powerful empires are characterized as trees in the Bible, large and strong, with their tops touching the sky, as Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon is described. But sometimes empires must be brought low and proud kings humbled. So a mere shepherd and keeper of the sycamore fig trees, like Amos, might be brought in to deliver the unpopular word of the Lord. It is the maker of trees who can cut down the tall tree and replant the low one to make it grow. With a God like this, trees are not always what they seem. God's people are like a tree, and they are therefore judged and pruned, sometimes severely, but never outright destroyed. Sometimes God needs to prune us, and sometimes that pruning hurts. But as I'm finding out, with the little orchard Jen and I have put into our property, you got to prune your fruit trees to produce more fruit, to produce better fruit, to produce bigger fruit. And God sometimes prunes us. Sometimes we don't understand the whys, but He prunes us to make us produce more, better, good fruit. One thing about the story of the trees in the Bible is that it is inevitably a story for the long term. Trees are mostly slow growers, but are all the more enduring for their deliberate pace. And this is exactly how God plans for His world also. Slow, but steady, and onward and upward. Jesus is coming again, amen? Is He coming as fast as we would like? But He's steady. He's slow. He's purposeful in what He's doing. Trees sometimes turn into weapons and siege ramps or fashion into tools for idolatry. But out of the cut stumps and smoldering ashes, God patiently matures life. Trees live on, and from the new growth, and from them new growth will emerge. Hope, symbolized by the trees, does not die. So it is that we find the heart of God's drama in the world in the story about the Messiah. He Himself was like His people, at first sight a man of no apparent consequence, merely a branch coming up out of the old stump of Jesse. But the Lord's Spirit rested on Him, and He did what He had come to do. He eventually used a tree to rescue the story of the trees and the story of us. It's a strange story indeed, the tale of this tree of the curse that must be faced in order for the long-lost tree of life to reappear. This branch of David came and did much good, healing and feeding and teaching the people. So when He entered Jerusalem as king, they cut branches from the trees and laid them out to honor and celebrate Him. They thought they knew what victory looked like. But Jesus said, "This is a hard time. A time you neither expect nor understand." And the decisive deed was done, not with waving of branches, but with the hanging upon a tree. And again, just like the staff of Moses, that tree that was made into a cross that Jesus was hung on, you don't think it felt the excruciating pain that Jesus was feeling? You don't think it felt the love of Jesus for every one of us? And the sacrifice He was making, what an honor for that tree to be holding the Son of God as He died for all of us, for a new earth, for new trees. No doubt it looked merely another dead man upon the same dead pieces of wood. This appeared plenty enough with the Romans, but this time was different because all along Israel's warrior had been fighting a different kind of battle. The spiritual forces of evil cannot be fought by those the Romans killed. When the Creator vindicated His work and raised Him from the dead, this unusual Messiah was mistaken for a gardener, which was just right since He really is the crafter of life. Indeed, He is a new temple, the place where God dwells with us, except now it isn't just in carvings of trees and fruit upon doors and walls, but rather life itself brought back to earth. That ancient life tree has been found, tended, and strengthened, so it can now restore everything in the middle of the city from which it has come. The scriptures tell us that to walk with Jesus is to walk back into God's garden. It is to be with God in the cool of the day. And the leaves are there for the healing of the nations, their trees, their people, everything. From Genesis to Revelation, to understand the trees is surely to understand the story. It is perfectly appropriate that in the end, it is the trees themselves that will sing the true song of this story. Hopefully, you have a little better appreciation for the trees. God made them for a purpose. They weren't just happenstance. They weren't just, oh, I think this would be pretty. God knew the importance of the trees. So how important are trees to us in our everyday lives? Well, trees provide food and seeds, which are food. Trees provide a lot of the medicines we use today. Do you realize that? A lot of the medicines that we take, that we use, cancer-fighting medicines, come from trees. They provide us with shelter, whether we're building our homes with them, whether we're laying under them for the shade. They stop erosion. They lower temperatures. They filter water. They sequester carbon dioxide, and they continually pump out the very oxygen that this entire world needs to live. And if you're like me, trees just make me happy. I love the trees. So if you haven't figured it out, what we're talking about today with the trees is legacy. You know, it said the only thing we'll take to heaven with us is our character. That character is our legacy. It's who we are as people. So we've been talking long enough now, or reading long enough. I want to do something with you. I want everybody that can. If you don't feel comfortable standing, please don't. But all of you that can, stand for me. Good time to wake up. Get some blood flowing back into you. And I want you to all look around. We are a forest of trees. Some of you, Jaden, are tall redwoods. Strong and tall. The wind doesn't bother you. The rain doesn't bother you. You're the tree. Some of us are oaks. Our roots run deep. Again, we protect everything else around us. And we still feed those around us. Some of us might be like the aspen. From one tree comes many. And you keep your family close. And you grow as one together. Some of us may be a cat claw. Yep, we're a little pricky when we get too close. We might even cut you if you get too close. And we're a pain in your neck. I get that. I kind of feel like a cat claw sometimes. But here's the thing. If you're needing shelter from the wild, if you're out in the boonies, and you hear the coyotes, other wildlife that may try to eat you or kill you in the middle of the night, you can crawl underneath that cat claw for shelter, and it will protect you. Trees aren't bad. Sometimes we just don't understand them. Today, what kind of tree are you? You guys can go ahead and be seated. Let me tell you the story of my tree. And we'll try to help you understand this better. When Jen and I came back from that trip from Oregon, the backpacking trip from Mount Hood, we had visited Jen's stepbrother up there and his wife. And they have a beautiful property there. Although it's on the outskirts of Portland, you wouldn't even know it's in the outskirts of Portland. You get to their house, It's blocked off and secluded by trees, by fences, a beautiful property. They have a pond in the back. They have fruit trees. Remember, we picked a couple bushels of Macintosh apples. We're eating them right off the tree. All kinds of fruit trees. He has, and Jaden would love to go there, he has a blackberry bush that's probably 12 foot high and probably as big around as a garage or bigger. It's massive. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands of blackberries. We picked bushels of blackberries and you wouldn't even know we even touched the bushes. It's thick. And then they have chickens and they have beautiful grass and just such a beautiful, serene environment. And one of those environments you could look at and go, wow, you could actually live here without the outside world. You produce enough food here, you could actually wouldn't even need to go to town to buy groceries. And Jed started thinking, I want a house like that. Now, we had a house here in Cottonwood, and it was almost paid off. And Jen started looking at houses, and one of the first houses she clicked on was the property that we actually bought. A very unassuming house, an old farmhouse that had been remodeled on the inside, but the outside, a little dated. Has wagon wheels out front, real wagon wheels, not fake wagon wheels, with bricks around them. Cute little place. When we came back, we went out to see the property in Cornville, right in the green belt. It had flood irrigation. It had a well. It had everything we were looking at to build a beautiful property that we could actually survive on. So we get to the property. We go out back. Plenty of big, beautiful trees. Big pasture area out back. A little area that we call our park, or a little forest that drops off. Big pond back behind the property. But the property itself was in rough shape. This house had been abandoned for a few years, and it hadn't been taken care of for several years. And the flood irrigation had not flooded anything on this property for a long, long time. The grass was dead. The grass was brown. The trees were weak-looking at best. And you probably heard the story of us getting this property. There was actually a cash offer on this property, and we were told that, there's a cash offer on it. Don't even worry about putting in a bid on it. Well, we did, and our bid was for less than the cash offer. And within just a few days, the cash offer fell through, and they accepted our offer. And we put our house up for sale, and within 24 hours, we had three, four people wanting to buy our home. We sold that home, bought this home, moved into the new home. It was perfect. Now, I got to tell you, even though when we got to that property, the property looked really rough. We were okay with that because we both liked doing the work outside. But when we stood out in that field looking at this property, the property, the trees, actually spoke to us. We both looked at each other and said, this is it. This is what we've been looking for. We don't want to look for anything else. This is what we want. And I think it was God's way of talking to us and saying, hey, you need this property. So once we got into the house, we opened up the flood irrigation. I cleaned out all the ditches. I dug them all out. I figured out how the flood irrigation worked. I filled in some of the ditches they had dug there that were actually useless and made different ditches. And we started to irrigate the property, and the property started to thrive. The grass turned a beautiful green. My back pasture is Bermuda grass, and it's like walking out on a lush carpet. The trees grew. These are some of my turkeys. I had to put them in there because they're just handsome little fellows, aren't they? These are some of the turkeys we raised out on the property. And things started going really well. You can see some of the trees there in the background. Once we started watering everything, we discovered that we had three mature apricot trees on the property we didn't know were apricot trees. Once they started getting water, they again started to produce fruit. We had nut trees on the property that we didn't know we had, pecan and a black walnut. Once we started irrigating, we realized what they were because they started producing their nuts. And the nut that lived there. That's funny, I'm the nut that lives there. Okay. You guys are a hard crowd. I know it's been a long time. I'm getting there, I promise. Some of the other trees we had on the property were some giant cottonwood trees. And although the giant cottonwood trees, we put in an orchard of all kinds of fruit trees too, by the way. But what I loved about the cottonwood trees is they brought us beautiful shade. Shade for our birds, our chickens, and our turkeys. And Jen and I are kind of amateur bird watchers. But because of the cottonwood trees, and because we're near the creek and the water down there, we have so many birds that come to our property in these cottonwood trees. Tanagers and buntings and warblers and all kinds of woodpeckers and cardinals and bluebirds and every kind of bird you see. Kingfishers. The back of our property, where our fence line ends, right immediately behind us, is a designated blue heron estuary. In the spring, the blue herons come and hatch their chicks there. And so we have blue herons all over the place. And we love that. We love being able to watch our birds. And they love the cottonwood trees. Cottonwood trees make wonderful homes, especially for the woodpeckers, because they're soft enough they can get in there and make a wonderful area. But here's the thing about cottonwood trees. Cottonwood trees grow really, really fast. Really fast. Some of these cottonwood trees you see along the river go, that must be 400 or 500 years old. They're probably not more than 75 or 80 years old because they grow so fast. And because of that, their wood's a little soft. And cottonwood trees absorb an enormous amount of water. They really suck up the water. So when we started our flood irrigation, these cottonwood trees just sucked it up. And they bloomed out green and beautiful and full of wonderful shade. We loved our trees. But because of the way cottonwood trees are, I woke up one morning after working a long shift to this. One of our big cottonwood trees had come down. I pulled another cottonwood tree with it that also pulled over, which you'll see in another photo. You can see my trailer there in the back. It just missed it. By inches. Unfortunately, underneath the top of that tree there was our turkey pen. Because it was nighttime, our turkeys were locked in there. You can see the turkeys that are running around now. So you know their story wound up good. But when this tree fell, I couldn't find my turkeys. That tree was so thick of leaves, I knew the turkeys were in there somewhere, but I didn't know if they were dead or alive. It took me 30 minutes to cut enough of the branches out so I could find my turkeys and get them out of there. Not one was hurt. And the amazing thing is they roosted on top of that pen quite often. But they were all saved from the crashing of the tree. I know, they told me I have to do it from over here. So there you can see the tree from a different angle. And you can see the tree that pulled over with it we also had to take down. And we lost our shade. You can see our garden right here in the front. We have about a 2,400 square foot garden. We're shortening that down every year because we're finding it's too much. We grow too much food sometimes. But the tree came crashing down. When the tree fell, it went through several of our buildings. That's our pole barn. We had a 36 by 16, I think it was, pole barn off the back of the property. It snapped it perfectly in half, so now I have a 16 by 16 pole barn because we didn't replace it. But you see all my farm implements were under there, and none of them got hurt. They were all saved as well. The tree also smashed through my llama barn. That's the llama barn I built. We have a llama, chickens, turkeys. You get the point. We got a little mini farm going on out there. It smashed through my llama barn. My llama barn was not in it at the time. My llama was not hurt. But this falling tree did a lot of destruction. That's after we cleaned the tree out. You can see how bad it smashed everything. That's where I went to my llama barn. My turkey coop. And then clean up. Now here's the thing. It was sad losing that big tree. It was really sad. But I don't want you to feel bad for me because all this stuff got smashed in my house. Because I was rebuilding a lot of the stuff myself. And what the insurance paid out, we actually came out okay. Instead of a pole barn, we actually put in a 10 by 20 full-size barn with a roll-up garage door and stuff to store all my stuff in, so it was better because it's enclosed. We wound up rebuilding the chicken and the turkey coops. But here's the thing. Remember I talked about the trees and their legacy. This tree has a legacy. Just like we are trees and leave a legacy. So people will tell you, you cannot burn a cottonwood tree. It stinks, it's lousy wood, it doesn't burn well. Well, you guys need to get out of your head here in Arizona about cottonwood trees. Cottonwood trees are actually related to the poplar. If you think about poplar trees in the Midwest, it's what they cut down to burn in their fireplaces and wood-burning stoves all the time. It's a good wood for heat. It's not the best. It's not really hot. But it heats your home. It doesn't stink if you properly cure it. See, the problem is with cottonwood trees, if you take a cottonwood tree down and you don't properly cut it and let it dry, and then split it and let it dry, and then keep it covered before you use it, every time it rains, it'll suck back up the water. And that's what makes it stink and not burn well. If you keep it dry, once you get it dry, this wood burns really well. You have to put a lot of it in your fireplace to keep it going because it burns up pretty quick, but it burns well. So our tree, leaving its legacy. We took the leaves from the tree, ran through our shredder, and we put it in our garden to give nutrients to our garden. And our garden grew some huge jalapenos that year. That is a jalapeno, believe it or not. I had tomatoes that wouldn't even fit in my hand that same year. And it was great for the garden. It helped the legacy of our garden. And that's a daily haul of zucchini and tomatoes and summer squash and cucumbers. And we have, because of the nutrients this tree provided to my garden, we have a lot of canned, frozen, and freeze-dried vegetables in our house for long-term storage. We've made gallons of spaghetti sauce through our tomatoes because we had so many tomatoes. We have canned tomatoes. We have frozen shredded zucchini. We have frozen butternut squash. We have freeze-dried butternut squash. We have frozen pumpkin puree. We have, believe it or not, you can can zucchini. We have what we call pineapple zucchini. I'll tell you about it sometime. It's wonderful. You use it in place of pineapple, but it doesn't have nearly the sugars and junk in it. It's zucchini. It's very nutritious. We have that preserved. We have all kinds of stuff preserved because this tree helped give us the nourishment that we use in our garden. This tree also, kind of hard to see, but the bigger branches, we have a shredder and a mulcher and a chipper. We run all the bigger branches through, and we use all that mulch and those chips for our orchard around the trees. We use it for the beds for our chicken and in our chicken and turkey coop areas on the ground for an absorbent so you don't get the smell of your turkey and your chickens, which you really don't want. So the tree gave back to help there as well. The tree was cut and stacked and dried. It does burn. And it split. Yeah, that other pile of wood you saw, that's not split yet. This is the ones that we did split so far. So here's the thing. Our house, when we bought our house because it's an older home, heats off of propane. And as you know, propane's gotten a little expensive. And to heat our house when we first bought it, it was cost us during the wintertime about $350 a month to heat the house, just in propane. So we bought a very efficient Vermont Castings wood-burning stove. Burns really clean, doesn't have any smoke when it comes out, and we now heat our house with the tree that fell in our yard. And now I pay $350 once during the winter to refill my propane tank, and that's it. Otherwise, we're heating with the wood. And not only that, but we actually have a cook stove top on our wood-burning stove. And sometimes Miss Jen will get out there and fry some eggs on that when we got the stove burning. And it's the most wonderful fried eggs you've ever had burning off that wood stove. So the tree continued to give back. But not only that, the ash then from that burning cottonwood tree gets scooped up into buckets and gets put back out into the garden. And if you don't know how important ash is to a good garden, trust me, it's super important. Remember I told you I grew up in northern Idaho, and I grew up around the huckleberries. Yeah, we got a lizard here joining us. In 1980, Mount St. Helens blew up in Washington, and that flume came clear across Washington, Idaho, and Montana. I wasn't living there at the time, but I'd already moved down to Arizona. I was at Thunderbird Academy. But I remember my dad calling me and saying, the years following Mount St. Helens eruption, that the huckleberries have never been like they are now. That ash provided so much nutrients and nourishment to the huckleberry trees, they just went nuts all across Washington, Idaho, and Montana. From that ash, that's how important that ash is. So, we lost our tree. We lost that beautiful shade. We lost that roosting place for all those wonderful birds we have on our property. But we gained so much more than that. We've gained things now from this tree that will enrich our property for years, that will help feed my family for years. So how about you today? What are the legacy you're leaving to your community, to your church, and to your family? And I'm not talking just when we're gone. That's one legacy. But I'm talking about while we're here right now, where when we make mistakes, because we will make mistakes, we're humans, we all will sin, and people see that, and they see how we recover from that, and how we react to that, and how we still move forward from that. That's a legacy we're leaving for somebody else about how to follow Christ, about how to move forward from your mistakes, and move forward and not look behind. Even when we make mistakes and we fail, our legacy can still provide the nourishment, shade, protection, oxygen, good fruit to those we share our legacy with. To those who see us, we are all trees. We all provide something to this community. We all provide something for our church. Let's make sure we're leaving something good, because by our fruits, they will know us. So I'm going to piggyback on Don from last Sabbath, because I think it's important. If you don't know where to start in building your legacy, if you're just struggling with building your legacy, if you're struggling with building your tree and getting it properly fertilized, Don's going to start taking care of that for you. Starting March 8th, Wednesday evening, 7 p.m., the spiritual emphasis on prayer, starting with steps to Christ. That's like a book on gardening, on growing trees, step by step. It's about growing you, growing your tree, growing into what you want to be so you can leave the legacy that friends, family, church members can see and grow with. Don't wait until you're gone to leave your legacy. Leave it now. My grandfather left me a legacy while he was still alive that I still appreciate to this very day and appreciate until the day I die. And hopefully I pass that on to Abigail and to Tyler and to Dawson and my grandkids and to you here in the church. We can only build this legacy by every day turning our lives over to God, spending time in prayer and in study, inviting Jesus every day to bless us with the mighty power of God.
Please stand.
I sing the mighty power of God that made the mountains rise, that spread the flowing seas abroad and built the lofty skies. I sing the wisdom that ordained the sun to rule the day. The moon shines full at His command, and all the stars obey. I sing the goodness of the Lord that filled the earth with food. He formed the creatures with His word and then pronounced them good. Lord, how Thy wonders are displayed when You turn my eye. If I survey the ground untrod or gaze upon the sky, there's not a plant or flower below but makes Thy glories known. And clouds arise and tempests blow by order from Thy throne. Creatures that borrow life from Thee are subject to Thy care. There's not a place where we can be, but God is present there.
Good afternoon, Father. As we leave here today, let us each find our tree. Let us each find the legacy that You want us to leave. Let us each one continue to grow strong, put roots down deep, and bear the good fruit of Jesus Christ.